나도 뭐 혼자 만나고 싶다 그래. 갈까? It is your motive. Ladies and gentlemen, you are welcome. Let's start. We're going to have a briefing from the Department of Energy on the Grand Inga project. I'm sure they are ready. Let's see if we have any apologies.
Thank you, Chair. The following apologies. Mr. Mackay, who had to attend to other rule matters, he won't be able to attend the meeting. And then Mr. Matlala, who's on sick leave. And then also Mr. Tuama, who indicated that he's attending another meeting. Then we also received apologies from the Minister of Energy, the Deputy Minister of Energy, and Director General of the Department of Energy, who are all currently abroad, Chair. Those are the apologies.
Thank you very much.
On the update regarding the development of the Grand Inga project in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Just to take you back by way of a disclaimer, we find a treaty. It's a framework treaty between South Africa and the DRC, and the purpose of the treaty is to just provide an enabling framework for the project and to allow for countries to exploit economically viable options for the development of the project. So basically, as opposed to other treaties where there is already a commercial agreement in place, in this case, this is a framework agreement that was signed first, and then the process going forward is to negotiate the commercial agreement. So that's the difference. Just in terms of what the treaty provides for, it provides for various institutional arrangements, including what is referred to as IDP, the French acronym, but it stands for the Inga Development Authority, on the part of the DRC. Then jointly between South Africa and DRC, the treaty also institutionalized what is referred to as a joint ministerial committee and a joint permanent technical committee. The top one, the ministerial committee, is obviously between the ministers responsible for electricity on either side, and then the joint permanent technical committee is for the senior officials that would then make sure that the process of developing the project goes through. Just some highlights in relation to the commercial aspects that have already been agreed to in the treaty is that South Africa first commits to buy the power generated from phase one of the project. So South Africa has agreed to buy 2,500 megawatts from the first phase, subject to certain conditions. And then over and above the 2,500 from the first phase, South Africa has an option. So we have a call option in regards to any subsequent phase from the project. The project itself in relation to phase one entails what is referred to as common works. Common works is largely the civil engineering work that needs to be put in place to build a dam, to put in the necessary raising of the infrastructure, the canals, and so on, to make sure that the water from the Inga, from the river is collected. Over and above common works is the cost related to the generation of the power itself. at the power station, we call it the generation infrastructure, and then lastly, the transmission infrastructure. In relation to the transmission infrastructure, and I'll show it graphically just now, is that the power gets delivered by the GRC at the delivery point. So the commitment that the GRC enters into South Africa is to deliver it at the border between South Africa, sorry, between the GRC and Zambia. And therefore, one needs to look at this project in two phases. There's a part that relates to the treaty, where the power is delivered very far from South Africa, about 3,000 kilometers away, or 1,500 kilometers away. And then South Africa has a responsibility to evacuate the power from the border of the GRC and Zambia into South Africa. Which therefore means that part of the problem for us, or the scope, involves a transmission infrastructure development project to bring the power through Zambia, Zimbabwe, or Botswana into South Africa. So we'll go into some detail around that. As I indicated, that's the breakdown for the first phase. It's 4,800 megawatts, 2,500 by South Africa. The important thing to note here is that without South Africa, the project will not happen. So basically, South Africa's 2,500 megawatt commitment anchors the project. It makes the project happen, because otherwise, this is too much power for any of the loads in the DRC to be able to accommodate. They have committed to 2,300 megawatts on the left, of which about 800 megawatts is in Kinshasa itself, and then the balance is on the eastern side of the country in Katanga district, which is a mining load. Then just in relation to what we have agreed to in the treaty, we refer to it as right of the refusal. This is the option that I've mentioned that we have referred to. And this right of first refusal is in respect of both equity. So in other words, we want to be owners of any of the phases. This is what the equity part relates to. We can buy up to 15% of any phase. Right? We have a right to take it up or to refuse not to take it up. And the reason we do that, if I can maybe just dispense with this, is because in the nature of these cross-border transactions, the power will be sold in dollars. So you have electricity that arrives in the country that is sent, that is sold in dollars. And this equity arrangement hedges the risk of the dollar fluctuation. That's why we insisted on an equity in there. And then we also have right first refusal in relation to offtake, which means not only are we the owner, but we have the right, to secure the right to buy a certain amount of that power for ourselves. Even if we don't need it, we may sell it to somebody else. So that's basically what this thing means. Interestingly, if we proceed with phase one, we have what we call a lock-in mechanism. So in other words, that we cannot move out of this except for the option, when we decide not to exercise the option. But similarly for the GRC, they cannot go around this particular issue. And this is very, they cannot renege on this commitment that we have made. As I indicated, the first phase is the most risky, is the most critical. And the idea is that in the subsequent phases, the project becomes more and more de-risked, and therefore South Africa has secured the ability to then buy into any of those future phases, because once we have really done the hard work, we would like to take advantage going into the future. Now, I have mentioned this just in terms of numbers, the right of first refusal for offtake is that we have a guaranteed minimum of 20% of the generated power, which is equivalent to about 9,500 megawatts, and a maximum of 18,000 megawatts. So basically, if one project, the size of the Inga project, it could well result in South Africa either buying 13,000 megawatts for itself, or buying 13,000 megawatts to sell to others in South region, and it's a bit clearer in the graphic just now. As indicated, we anticipate that the economies to become better in subsequent phases. Just by way of illustration, in the first phase, as I indicated, you're building a wall around a dam. You're collecting water in some basin. And this is very risky business because of a whole lot of things, hydrology, the geology of the sedimentation, and so on. So once you have done that, the next phases relate to using exactly the same dam to include subsequent phases. So as indicated, it's not as risky as that. And therefore, I'm underscoring the point that as we go into the subsequent phases, we expect the generation cost per megawatt to decline. And therefore, we would be able to get advantage of a low cost of clean electricity in the future. One of the conditions, as indicated, the lock-in anchors at the point when we commit to take phase 1, 2,500 megawatts, if feasibility and commercial terms are acceptable. So it's not an automatic lock-in. We have protected ourselves by way of a feasibility and having to deal with the commercial terms that are acceptable to our government. For any future participated in the project, in the project, the Congolese have insisted that there needs to be a commitment fee to the kind of $10 million, which goes into an escrow account, so that we do not renege on our commitment. So, for example, once we have committed, if there are commercial issues that are not satisfactory to South Africa, we have a right to walk away. And when we do walk away, they're saying that there would be a fee of $10 million paid in the subsequent phases. Yet to the detail of the protocol relating to that, it's yet to be developed because we're not at the stage yet. Just in terms of terms, the companies may not sell this power to any other off-taker, any other buyer, on terms which are better than the terms that South Africa will negotiate for itself. And no other third-party agreement will trump this agreement, this treaty that we have with them. So it's a provision that's built into the treaty. Then just in terms of the volumes, I said 13,000 megawatts, but that's the capacity. We may negotiate additional volumes of energy should they become available in the future. I've already mentioned this, so for interest of time, I'm going to skip this, save for mentioning that the equity participation, as I indicated, is 15% at least. So whoever is going to be a successful company chosen by the Congolese to develop this project, 50% of that equity is available for South Africa to secure for itself. There may be just in terms of creating some comfort around the tariff, what is the likely cost associated with this project. There is a mechanism in the treaty which relates to the tariff setting and principle. It says that it shall be subject to negotiation, but the principles are for the developer, obviously it will cover the cost and the return and the fees imposed by the DRC. This is very similar to our Electricity Regulation Act, which provides that ESCOM recovers its cost and entitled to a fair return. It's exactly the same principle. There are certain fees imposed by the DRC, if you like, let's call them taxes, right? So those taxes would be for our will be in charge to us, and we refer to them as fees. What are those fees? For example, the Congolese think that there needs to be a fee in relation to the water, because the water is free energy, so they likely want to recover a cent per liter of water that goes for 4 per megaliter, and so on. Then another mechanism is that we have built in the ability to compare this to other alternative projects. So, for example, we have on the eastern flank an arrangement with Mozambique. It's called the Kaurabata project. You might be familiar with that. And we have built in a mechanism that allowed us to compare the power that comes from Inga with the power that comes from Kaurabata from a cost perspective. Because if there are cheaper options that are available elsewhere, we have reserved the right that we can negotiate on the basis of the cheaper alternatives. The Congolese have also agreed that the, if you like, the alternative price is the cost of generation from coal, because coal is the least cost producer or was the least cost producer at the time. And we believe that from the baseload point of view, the coal probably is the best one to use. Then just the graphical illustration to give you a sense about what we're dealing with here. The power goes from Inga, which is about, let's call it 200 kilometers from the Atlantic Ocean, from the mouth of the river. And then it goes all the way east towards Kolwezi. Kolwezi is just north of the Zambian border. It's 1,800 kilometers, just to keep from center distance. And then from Kolwezi, coming all the way to, at that point, the Hans Grand Ski scheme in Limpopo, this would have been another 1,500 kilometers. So we're talking about 3,600 kilometers to deliver this power through those countries. That's our point, is that at this point here, where it says Lubumbashi, you can see on the map just the way it says Lubumbashi, that's the delivery point as you find in the treaty, so they will dump the power at Lubumbashi, and then South Africa is responsible for evacuating that power from the Lubumbashi point all the way into our country. Just a little bit of elaboration on that. This is perhaps one of the most risky aspects of the project from South Africa point of view. Areas, delivery points and options were considered in order to make this thing possible. I'm going to spend some time giving some progress on what we have done. As I indicated, the Congolese are responsible for doing this in Congo, sorry, in the GRC. And South Africa is responsible for sorting out the transmission. So I will reflect on what the Congolese have done on their side, give an update, and do the same in relation to what we have done on the South African side as well. So the delivery of the power to Katanga is from Inga to the border with that. It's about 2,000 kilometers. So the idea here is that because of the quantity of power that's involved, one of the options that was considered the so-called AGDC system, very similar to what we have with Mozambique, because it is really, it's a lot more efficient for transferring power over large distances. The problem with the AGDC system, though, is that we would not have been able to terminate it or deliver the power as required by the Congolese. If I can just go back to it, please. So the delivery system works as in generator power at that point here, but you have to drop some of it here because the Congolese want their power inside the country, and then you have to drop the balance down there. Now, this is a very difficult technical feat because in the world, there are not many of these kind of systems that have been put in, so-called multi-terminal, which means usually you just generate power from this point, and you drop it at another point, and that's it. So end to end, it's 2 points. The multi-terminal is something that takes the power from here, drops it somewhere else, and then drops it elsewhere. So it makes it very difficult, you know, to control the power. So just to cut a long story short, one of the options that we have settled on then is that instead of it being a so-called multi-terminal, the proposal is to build the power all the way from Inga, or the transmission line rather, all the way from Inga into South Africa as a one link. The HVDC system does not stop in Kolwezi and then go to. So you secure South Africa's power by building a link all the way from Inga into the South African system. And you deliver the 2,000 megawatts like that. Then the question remains, but what is it for the Congolese? Because this is part of, you know, the requirement that they need to also get power in the Katanga district. So basically what you then do, you build from the source another link that drops their power, as in illustrated on the dotted line, that drops their power in a place called the Subalesa. So that's a big difference between the mass terminal and the two HVDC system as opposed. The point about this, honorable members, is that we have gone through a process between the utilities, between SNEL and the ESCOM, in order to arrive at this proposal, because any other proposal makes the project extremely risky because of the difficulty with managing a multi-terminal HVDC link. So the idea then is that we look at two options where, insofar as getting access, if you think about it, we're now trying to build an HVDC transmission line through somebody else's country, through Zambia. It's interpreted here as Zimbabwe as well, into South Africa, but it can also go through Botswana. So this is not an exact, you know, routing of the line. But nonetheless, you have to take it through somebody else's country. So the point then becomes, how do you deal with that? And the way that we intend to deal with that is to provide full Zambia and all the so-called transit countries a stake in this project. And you do that because from Kasumba Lekwa, you can interconnect. As you can see here, there's an AC. So you look at there, I don't know what color it is. Reddish color. So you can build some interconnector from Kasumba Lekwa into Zambia. And in lieu of that, secure right of way. That is the concept here. And we have engaged with both Zambia and Zimbabwe very recently with Botswana in regards to this concept as an option, and they're fairly excited about it. This then makes this project a more strategic kind of multilateral project as opposed to the way that the treaty is written, which is a bilateral agreement between South Africa and there. So we need to understand that much as the bilateral treaty, the nature of the project is multilateral, mainly because of the transmission problem that we have to address. On the rest of the slide, I'm not going to go into the details, but just shows the various networks and how, for example, even the Zimbabweans can tap into this system and further down, how we can also, if you look at this, we can also feed into the Botswana system as well. Incidentally, this short line here at the bottom is currently under feasibility. If you think about the various export options that we can get to, these little islands here indicate that there is a need for us. In the sea, there's a need for us to build an interconnector into Zambia, which is the South African power pool is looking into. And as I indicated, there's a need for us to build another interconnector into Botswana, which is at the advanced feasibility stage. And that way, this project will be able to feed into Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Botswana. On this slide, what we do is we also indicate this projected cost based on this configuration, as I explained, point-to-point HVDC system. I think around 68 billion rands in 2014 rand to dollar terms. Okay, so over and above having considered that point-to-point HVDC configuration system, we score it various against other options that I haven't gone into detail around it because it gets into really heavy engineering analysis, but I'm not going to bore you with that. So basically what we're saying is that this system, right, with the HVDC system from the inner side into South Africa and then a separate one into the GRC border itself with Zambia, is reliable, it ticks the box on performance, the technology is very matured out there, the number of systems like this has been widely used within the industry, and more importantly is that there are certain issues around land rights, so the right of way issue that as I said you can be dealt with in a particular way. So what has happened is that this recommendation has been made to the project team on the Congolese side. And there is as I indicated, there is a JPTC, the Joint Permanent Technical Committee, which is South African and Congolese officials with the technical experts. And this transmission solution has been tabled to them. And in relation to how this fits the bill, so to speak, is that we have also checked that there are 42 similar installations in the world from which we can learn, as opposed to the other first option, the multi terminal, which I have indicated. We are aware of one in Canada, and it is extremely risky to operate this in like that. But, so, just to summarize and to come back to this, basically we're saying that the idea is we will build the dotted line, the dotted line, a line from Urezi, sorry, from Inga all the way into South Africa to deliver 2,100 megawatts. And then we build another one to Kasumbalesa to feed the Congolese. And then the Congolese mining load in Kananga would be serviced. It's so far as Kinshasa is concerned, you don't see it, it's a very small load. But they would then have to find a solution from Inga and to Kinshasa, which sits somewhere around the point here. Okay, so technically what we argue is that there is a solution that is able to generate power from the Congo, from the Congo River, deliver the power as required by the areas of data being SNEL in Kinshasa, as a mining load in Katanga and South Africa. It also makes it possible for us to scale this transmission line for future phases. So once we have dealt with that line, that long one that comes into South Africa, and we need to go into the next phase, it means that we already have built the highway. That's what the point about de-risking first phase. We've already built the highway. It's just a question of generating more and extending down. Okay. If I can now move off the transmission solution issue, which is a big chunk of our work, and go back to the work that the Congolese have done and to advance the project. I'm going to focus on a very significant aspect of their process, which relates to the selection of their preferred developer. If I can maybe just take it, you know, to the side a little bit, is that in the treaty, we have identified that there are a number of legislative and regulatory instruments that the Congolese need to put in place. For an example, they do not have an electricity act like what we have. They do not have a regulator. And as such, regulatory certainty is very difficult to understand. And part of their commitment is that over and above the institutions that they put in place, they will put the necessary legal instruments in place. They have, in fact, last year, they promulgated what is referred to as the Inga Law. So they passed a specific law which defines how the concession around the development of the Inga project is going to work. So I'm not going to dwell with that, I mean to deal with that at this point. I'm just going to focus on the things that have in relation to the selection procedure. The process started when they issued an expression of interest in October 2010 with 9 respondents. Of that, 6 were selected, 3 withdrew, and the 3 indicated their interest to pursue the process further. In May 2011, they issued an information memorandum for the project, normally called a PMI in our jargon, Project Information Memorandum. They just call it a memorandum for the project. Information memorandum for the project. Over and above that, they issued an addendum in August 2011. So you can see over a period of about 2 years, they have been engaging with the shortlisted project developers in relation to a feasibility study. They've done a pre-feasibility study and appointed through the funding of the World Bank and the African Development Bank. They have developed a pre-feasibility study which covers the various aspects of the project. Needless to say, the transmission aspect was not dealt with adequately to South Africa's requirements, mainly because they don't know the system on the side, and that's why I just spent some time indicating how we have aligned that with this process. They then, in 2012, indicated to the shortlisted leaders that there would be additional study that they need to put in place, the so-called complementary studies agenda. Now, in that complementary studies agenda, a number of shortcomings had been identified in the pre-feasibility study, and the idea was to manage the basis for proceeding with the preferred bidder. Because you could have had a situation where the project had to be started simply because there would have been a change in scope or in the plan to the detriment of the project.
Then the Prime Minister decided in January 2013 that the shortlisted bidders process would continue, they would not start it from scratch. There was an entity put in place called CODESI, which is the predecessor of what I refer to as ADP, because ADP is a function of the treaty. CODESI is a DRC construct which anticipates the inception of ADP. So for all intents and purposes, ADP has been put in place as called CODESI, which is a very significant process, a program. This was in March last year. Just in terms of the consortium, we don't have a list of the six, but just the last three that have been shortlisted. It's a European, Chinese, and let's call it Canadian consortium. The first one is with these companies as indicated there, and they have also financial partners. The second one is with the Chinese consortium. Just incidentally, CTG is China Three Gorges. They currently operate the largest scheme like this in the world. And then the last one, SNC Lavalin, is Canadian in a partnership with two Korean companies. What has also been allowed in terms of the Congolese process is for these three consortia to be able to recoup. So in other words, they can bring in additional members and they may replace the member that they, but the core attributes of the consortium should not be compromised, is the principle. This was then taken through the lenders process and it was ratified by the lenders to the project, the funders for feasibility being African Development Bank and the World Bank. So the process is proceeding on the basis of these three shortlisted bidders. At the time, they had indicated in June last year that they were going to issue a bidding process, and by June last year, they had not done it because there had been certain problems around offtake. There had been some political changes in the DRC as well, and this process was delayed. They then settled on what they referred to as a two-phase selection process, and this is the process that have now embarked upon. So in January this year, they issued stage one of this two-phase or two-stage selection process, and that's where it should in January this year. And what does the two-stage process entail? The first stage relates to technical, financial, and legal matters. In other words, it's got nothing to do with pricing whatsoever. It's more around how would each of the consortia, how they would approach the process or the project from a technical, financial, and legal point of view. So it's more like the innovation aspect of this. As I indicated, there is a feasibility study, and the feasibility study has certain, if you like, shortcomings, and the idea is that each of the developers would reflect on that and propose how they can fix that. Then there's also the issue around the industry low-head project. So if I can maybe just explain just like this. The INGA project was conceived probably 8 years ago. Currently, there is on the INGA side two generators running, actually three. There's INGA 1, INGA 2, and INGA 3, all sharing the same water. The concern had been raised that if you bring in such a big scheme and divert the water from the river, you might affect the ability of the other already running phases to continue producing power, because you're now taking the water away and diverting it to another scheme. And there was a particular concern around the so-called Inga 3 Lowhead project, because it was the most affected by its modification to the run of river and so on. And part of stage one competition relates to how you can improve the coherence of the phase of the project in a manner that does not adversely affect it, but also be able to deliver on the Inga scheme as conceived now. And then the third point relates to transferring the design risk in the phase onto the selected bidder. So basically what it means is that notwithstanding again that there's a feasibility study, the bidder is supposed to then come with a solution that they can stand behind and take complete responsibility around the risk associated with it. So we now need to get into a situation where a counterpart is being identified, where all the time the counterpart has been the DRC. Graphically, this is what it looks like. It's not as clear at the bottom, but I'll try and explain what it means. So basically what happens is that in respect of the selection for bidder stage one, is that there would be the issuing of the tender document. This was done in January of this year. There is a process for the candidate to then look at the document and read back. So in other words, they would be able to raise questions, there would be an exchange with the candidate, and that information would be used to draft the final tender document. So it's almost like a so-called best and final offer, using the information that would have been taken from the candidate. This process is supposed to last about 6 months, so the idea is that from January until June, they would be able to finalize the final tender document and then get into stage two. Stage two follows more or less the same kind of process. There would be a tender document, there would be a response, and then the difference now is that there is a so-called definitive on that third point. Sorry, my voice is not working properly, but there is a definitive financing plan. So only in stage two would they submit a financing plan, and that would then be approved, leading to the selection of the proposed concessionaire in line with the DRC adjudication processes and so on. And then, as I indicated, there are those regulatory issues that are running in parallel, including the Inga law, because the Inga law is the underpin for the concession agreement, and the concession agreement is what the winning bidder would then sign with the Congolese, and that becomes the end of the process. What we have not clarified as the last engagement we had with them is whether there would be a winning concessionaire, or shall we say a winning bidder, and a reserve bidder, just in case there are issues that have yet to be finalized between the wind concessionaire and South Africa. So the idea is that we would come in at the point here once they have selected the preferred bidder. So others are on their side, and we are a buyer, and we would then engage insofar as those elements are concerned that are outlined in the treaty. But having said all that, is in the project meetings that we have with them, we have a line of sight in relation to the process. So it's not like this is secret to us. So we have a sense about what the term sheet for the bidding and sales and so on. Just days, as I indicated, in January 2016 would have been the day for the issuing of the first stage, which was definitely done. And they call it the second tender, but the 1st of January, and I believe they have met that milestone. By the end of 2016, they would have firstly issued the second stage around June, and then finalized the concessionaire by the end of this year, and then hopefully sign the concession contract in 2017, and then financial close, I imagine, and then the expected commercial operation date is around 2023, which is about 6 years from the date of signing of the concession agreement. Just in terms of the next steps on their side, the transmission project, we need to define how we bring the power. That's what I started with. So we do have a definition of the transmission project there right now. Say for the project relates to engaging those so-called transit countries to finalize the transit arrangement. Then there's the issue with the PPA term sheet. South Africa buys 2,500 megawatts, and therefore we have a very big role to play in terms of defining what is in the power bridges agreement. So that's what PPA stands for, power bridges agreement. And there's also an issue with the tariff protocol to negotiate in detail what the tariffs entail, and also the technical protocol in relation to operation of the system. You can imagine you've got a utility in the DRC, SNEL, you've got two other utilities on the same line, you've got Eskom at the end, and there needs to be coordination between the three of them to make sure that the line operates properly. Then there's the issue around, we refer to them as the main points on bias guarantees. If I can maybe just explain very quickly, the reason that South Africa is able to buy the 2,500 is on the back of a representation by a credible buyer. Eskom has a track record in relation to buying less quantity of power, even from the cross-border point of view. I indicated there in Mozambique, where Eskom is buying from DRC, actually from Kaurabasa. This is unfortunately not the same with all the other buyers. In this case, SNEL in Katanga, the 2,300 megawatts, their ability to buy the 2,300 megawatts is very limited. The ability of SNEL to buy 800 megawatts in Kinshasa is also very limited. The project cannot proceed on the basis of, if there is no conclusion of the offtake arrangement. And in this type of transaction, it is almost certain that there would be sovereign guarantees required on the part of the DRC. So the DRC government will have to issue guarantees to make sure that the project could continue. And there is a process with the World Bank and so on to facilitate that, ensure that they exist. So that's part of what needs to happen as part of the critical items on that side. I have mentioned the issue around the collaboration on the various complementary studies. The tariff study thing is underway. We actually had a mission in September last year in terms of defining how the tariff is likely to work. Then there's the issue around the phasing. As indicated, the first phase is 4,800 megawatts, us buying 2,500. But already there is a process, there is a study to project the future demand in the sub-region, not just in South Africa, but in the other countries as well, in order to get a sense when the subsequent phases are likely to be required. The transmission issues, I have indicated, Eskom, SNEL, ZEPA, ZESCO, have constant engagement, including the utility in Botswana to resolve them. Then on the part of the South African share of supply, if you like, our role in this is that since 2014, we signed the treaty, was it in 2014? I think it was in March, well, in July, I apologize for that, different thing. And then the transmission integration concept was developed around 2014, end of 2014, beginning of last year, and then engagement with the DRC in relation to our concerns around the bankability of the project without the transmission having been brought, but we now pass that. We are comfortable that we technically are able to evacuate the power from there into South Africa. As I indicated, a project has started with the utilities in Zambia and Zimbabwe around the transmission solution and their participation in it. We have yet to finalize at the SADC level the political agreements with those countries. Then, as the DRC goes into stage one of their selection process, there is a process on our side which relates to offtake negotiations with the counterpart that has been selected, but also to secure the necessary approvals, the Section 66, Section 70 of the PFMA, and on the part of ESCOM Section 54 of the PFMA, and so on. But that is only once we have concluded some of the comfort that we need to get in relation to the process that we have undertaken the DRC side. And then we would go into the supporting agreement. We expect that it's very likely to be a very high-level political agreement. You can even think of additional treaties with Zimbabwe, Zambia, or Botswana in relation to the transmission agreement that we entered into. So it's the best way of securing it so that it's not just a commercial thing. There's a transmission line that goes through your country, provides power to another country. You know, you secure it as best you can. And that's one Mozambique. We have the Kaurapa arrangement in a really similar kind of way. There's a treaty with Mozambique, and it deals with the HVDC link. We have not been able to indicate when we ourselves will conclude the uptake arrangement, and that's why there are no dates there. And it's very simple. It's mainly because the Congolese have yet to select their preferred candidate. And as I indicated, it's only at the end of 2016 that they will do that, and we would look to reach commercial terms a year thereafter. So that's where we stand. Thank you very much, Chair. Maybe I'll be to also mention that on our part, one of the concerns in relation to the JPTC, the technical team that works together, is that there is an office in Kinshasa, and there is, you know, Pretoria, we sit in Pretoria. So what we have indicated to them is the secondment. So we have agreed that with them that we will second a French-speaking technical expert in their office so as to keep close watch on the progress of the project on their side, so that we're not as remote as what we currently are. Currently, we probably would travel to the DRC every 3 months or so, which is not sufficient if you enter this place. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the update. I can see there are no questions. We do have a question. Honorable Van Dalen and Honorable Mandela.
Yes, thank you, Chairperson. From the presentation, I can see a lot of thought has gone into this project, and any green project has been commended, because we all, you know, want to see us go green. It's very important, and this is, hydro is one of your best based green projects you can get. But there still are some questions that I need to ask. Some of them are clarity, so I'll proceed. You know, the land rights that has to, how long will land rights take to procure? I mean, you will cross people's land, will it just be government land that
you are going to build this highway on the
conductor. Is it land that's been set out and already been procured? We know that if we want to build a new transmission line or a railway line, even in South Africa, we have difficulty doing it. How is it going to manage that system in another country? You know, you have the option where we take the power to Katanga, ne? And if we take it from the border and bring it down through Zambia and Zimbabwe. That is one option, to have one line and then we have managed it. You say it's going to be difficult to manage, but it is manageable. What is the cost of that in relation to the cost of building from Kaorabasa a line, right down, which will be dedicated to us, and then we have to build the other line to Katanga as well. What is the difference in cost on that? I would like to know that, and why don't we do that first until the phases are in place and we get scale up the project, and then we can do the rest and build an extra line, because that other line would already be there. It seems like it's double work in advance. You understand what I'm saying? If we have more surety and more security of supply and we are scaling up the project, we can then think about putting the direct line down, because it will be in their interest to also keep the power on. They can't just switch the switch and say, we don't want to give you any power. I mean, that will be ridiculous because the whole system would then be unstable. That's what I wanted to know. And then, and on the land rights, how long will that take us to procure that? And then the building of a power line there, I would say that would take at least 10 years and a very lot of copper. I would like to know where that copper is going to come from. Do we have it? I don't think there is so much copper freely available. We have to set up extra copper mines to get that. And then you say the power line that we will be building is going to be a highway, so it will be able to carry the 13,000 megawatts. So we're going to build an A-grade power line, and we're only going to get 2,500. Oh yeah, another thing is that for every 1,000 kilometers you transport DC power, you lose about 5% on load factor. That's about 4,000 kilometers. So you lose about 20% of your of what we are buying. The 2,500 megawatts, is that what we get in the end, or is that what we are procuring from Inga? Who's going to pay for the difference? Where is that going to go to? Is that factored into the price? And then in the end we get 20% less electricity than 2,500. Because if I see the procurement amount the generated amount is 4,800, and you divide it by everybody that needs, then there is no space left for the load loss factor. If you can just explain that, please. And then January 2015 is given as the date the land right will be resolved. I would like to know what the status on that is, because it doesn't seem like that has happened yet. And if a project, how will this deal affect the IRP? The 2,500 megawatt is delivered by 2023. As you have said, is the date that we might be finished with this, then it will ease the pressure on nuclear, and this is obviously baseload, so then we wouldn't be, we don't have to potentially replace or get all the nuclear that you are talking about. How will this affect IRP? You must please tell me. And then what lessons have we learned from the Mozambican line? I mean, we have the Mozambique line. I think it delivers as 1,000. It has a potential of delivering 1,800 megawatts. If I'm not mistaken, it could be 800. But it's very intermittent. It's not there all the time, and you can't depend on it. We've heard Eskom and everybody tell us there are lots of problems there. So how? What have we learned, and what are we fixing in this process on there? And have we learned lessons, or are we just doing the same? And then, given the imminent downgrade of the junk status, how is this going to end? And the cost overruns. Because cost overruns you must never underestimate. I mean, these costs that you have are from 2040.
that we are already 2 years later and you can't give us an updated price on what it's going to cost us today. I mean, so there are going to be huge cost overruns. I would say that if it costs us 12 billion in 2040, it might cost us 20 billion now. You know, I would have liked you to tell us so that I don't have to guess, because you are the experts of it, you know, so maybe it's 18, maybe it's 15, but it will be more than what it was 2 years back, because a lot of things have happened. And then how will this downgrade and affect this deal? Please, can you tell us that? And in the BRICS Bank, are they also going to finance part of this? Or have you looked at it? Then, you know, the question on most South African lips are, you know, where are the Guptas going to figure in this? You know, nothing happens in South Africa with the Guptas not having a finger in the pie. So where are they going to have their finger in this pie? Or is that for later? Maybe in the procurement of copper. So, but that is what I would like to know. And, oh yeah, there was one other thing. I think I just asked that, two different options. Yes, and what is the estimated cost to finish of the INGA project yet and the conductor line together? What is it going to cost us? The total cost. Can you give us a figure on that, please? Thank you. You know, we talk about the cost of the INGA project and then the added cost to South Africa of the power lines. I don't think that's included in, it doesn't seem to me like it's included. It seems like something we still have to go and renegotiate, or we still have to find the cost of the building of the transmission line. I would like to know what that cost plus the INGA cost altogether is as a package deal. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I've got a few clarities on the presentation. I understand that the presentation is on Grand Inner 3, because 1 and 2 is there already. Now we are busy with the development of a tree. In your presentation, Mr. Open, you are saying there is no electricity act or a regulator in the DRC. How did they go about with INGA 1, INGA 2? In terms of ensuring that necessary laws are in place, if only now they are going to have the what is so-called INGA law. How did they go about in dealing with all these things? I'm surprised that there are no laws in that country when it comes to issues of electricity. But this project is not a new one. There's been INGA 1 and INGA 2. The new design of INGA, it allows the development of Grand INGA to have independent phase or phases that can be operated by different operators. Now, I want to check whether the IPP office is involved, because when we talk about independent producers or operators, I think that the IPP office should be involved on this particular project. In terms of the political stability in that country, I don't think that we are safe, but I want to check whether the feasibility study looked into the risk in relation to the unstable political situation in that particular country. Because I don't want South Africa to regret in the end when the instability politically compromises the whole project, because the opposition will have something to write on, and we really need to cut against that. Election is better than you. You are talking about bilateral, multilateral kind of an arrangement. The treaty that South Africa signed is on bilateral. And now, in a way, the shift to multilateral. Is there any, or will there be no impact about that, or this move from bilateral to multilateral? The cost of the project itself, you're saying, is $68 billion. I'm a South African. I don't understand dollars, and I don't have a calculator. Can you, you know, empower me on that one and translate this $68 billion into South African rands? How much is it really in a true sense? The question which I want to pose on this cost is whether the cost includes the cost of the transmission lines. Because your slides here is not reflected properly. I could not grasp what the slide was trying to communicate to us. In South Africa, we are the principal buyers in the project. Now, being principal buyers and energy as the interface, if I may put it like that, of the country in this particular project, do we have an attachee? Do we have an attachee in the DRC that is representing our aspirations and interests as per the treaty which South Africa signed with the DRC? Because I think that we need to have somebody attached in that particular country that will look and safeguard our interests. One last issue. I'm not interested in the Guptas. I'm interested in checking whether the Oppenheimers, the Rupert's, and the Walmarts of this world, and Raymond Ackermans of this world, are going to have a stake on this particular project. I won't talk Guptas because I know the frustration out there is that since the arrival of the Guptas, the political forces have shifted from the east to the west, and that's the fundamental problem that we are sitting with in this country. So I'm less interested in the Guptas because they are assisting us in terms of shifting the balance of forces in the world. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Honorable Chair. In fact, Honorable Mangeshala assisted me in one of the questions I was going to ask in relation to political stability. Maybe one can say, on top of the question, to say, at what point do our intelligence come to picture with regard to putting ears on the ground in anticipating perhaps the unintended political instability in all those countries which will be partaking in this project? Chairperson, on slide number 21, bulletin number 2, it says issue of second tender document targeted by the 31st of January 2016. I just want to find out as to whether this has been realized or has started to get to the place. Last Chairperson, it's just a comment to say, I think this presentation for the first time, I see a presentation that is specific, that deals with things which us as politicians can be able to play our oversight role on it. Because it is base, it is what it takes to be a program, and of course it's an update. And we appreciate the fact that this program is generally targeting the subject countries, which means in one way or the other we are strengthening our relationship with our neighborhood countries with regards to development. It is not a question of whether we can take it from India direct to South Africa, because we need to take in play other countries to say we can't do it selfishness as a country, because there is that mutual dependency between neighboring countries. So I just wanted to appreciate this initiative, Chairperson. Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I was going to say that the World Bank ranked the Congo among the world's most difficult to do business in. For decades already, projects to expand and to develop Inga never got off the ground due to conflict and misrule. And the World Bank, by the way, is also the one who is going to sponsor this project. Not a good task. Since they paid for Enrico's wedding, they've basically... also, what concerns me is there seems not to be an escape clause or provision made for South Africa to get out of this if things don't work out. At this stage, in the Congo itself, only about 9-10% of the people actually benefits from the 65 million people in the Congo benefit from the electrical or have access to electricity from Inga 1 and 2. Inga 1 and 2 currently only operate at 30% of its capacity due to neglect and misuse. And also not too long ago, a couple of years ago, rebels seized Inga 2 and held the whole system, the whole capital of Kinshasa was actually without electricity for nearly 21 days. So it's very, very unstable. Now we also want to build transmission lines, and they have been set, but over more than 3,000 kilometers over some of the most political and stable regions in Africa. It is also a very big concern. And we also that this whole project has taken decades already to develop, and it hasn't really gone anywhere. We have South Africa now involved with one of the customers, BHG Bulletin, who is a pet subject for me and Honorable von Dahlen, was also involved on that, and they pulled out because they see they couldn't get power for free as they get it in South Africa. And that put the Inga 3 scheme back again. So Inga 3 is not really going anywhere. I can't see it now. Even with South Africa, South Africa has set aside 200 million in 2013 already for this project, which is already hopefully still exists. Maybe giving performance bonuses to Eskom's executives already. I agree with some of the measures. All initiatives aimed at sustainable, clean energy, we all agree and would want that. But we also say that an effectively run health system or educational system, education by the way is a big cut of the budget, in reality we could never happen, and that's my same feeling about the Ingo system. Thank you.
I do see there at the end say 2,194, so that is being that goes into the country. Yeah, I think that's all.
Thanks, Chair. If you can perhaps just start with the questions, the technical questions, and I must say I'm a bit interested with the technical understanding. The type of project, Chair, we did not discuss the so-called load flows. But this is in the jargon, this is what you are asking for. So the power does not respect anything but the fine. So the power, you're 100% right. The power, it does not mean that the numbers that you see here is exactly what gets delivered. So there are losses, and just to deal with it, so we don't build copper transmission lines anymore. It's all aluminium now. So there's no problem about that. But you have line losses, so what you send out is not the same as what you receive because of losses. But the treaty provides that at the delivery point, which is the border, right? So at that point there, your delivery point, you must measure 2,500 receives to be sent to South Africa. So we're responsible for that. But what you send down to South Africa will not arrive at 2,500 because there will be losses. But even more is that the power will flow into Zimbabwe in Zambia. And in fact, I did not go into the technical detail, but that's one of the reasons that you want a bypass, you want a dedicated line like that. Because when you did the load flows, the so-called load flows, no power would have arrived in South Africa. It would have been it would have dissipated in those countries, and we would have then have to offset. So it's an interconnected system. What they would have received, which was not due to them, they would have had to compensate. They would have to then get compensation for it. So that's the nature of the so-called load flow. But that's power systems, and so we're not going into that. So how you deal with that is to say, at the delivery point is 2,500 megawatts. Right? That's what we pay for. That's what we receive. Whatever else Zambia gets and Zimbabwe gets out of our hour that was sent to us, we enter into those arrangements in order to get compensation for it. It's almost like what they push here, currently what we do is we're exporting into them. And with this project, because it would have been exported from somewhere else, we would not have to, the power would not be exported from us, but we would get the benefit of somebody else, so it's an offset. It's not like you follow the electrons in the way that it's illustrated. So that's a little bit of the engineering, but basically that is the biggest reason that we moved away from that option. If I can take you back, the option that members are referring to is this one here, where you would have, so this is the one with the X, where is it? No, sorry, I don't have it here. But I can you see that we say, on this side here, we say no AC winning arrangements. The AC winning is what we were talking about. Winning is where the power goes, you know, wherever it wants, but we assume that was my power, so it's been willed somebody else. It just went to somebody else, and we didn't get compensation for it. So we avoided the winning in the way that the system would, you know, would... The winning that would result in the configuration of the system has been dealt with by doing a point-to-point DC transfer. So that's a technical part, and I'm not going to bore you with any of that any further. But yes, so there are losses. We will, for example, they will also take losses because that distance is 1,600 or 1,800 to Kasumba Lesa. That would be for their charge. So the generator would charge what is sent out, and we would pay what we receive plus the losses. The Congolese and Kasumba Lesa would pay what they receive plus the losses. And that's how it will be compensated. But that's the point about the Chair, you raised a question around the bilateral arrangement in the treaty, which is a political platform. But as you can see here, commercially, this is not a bilateral. You cannot deal with this at a bilateral project, just a commercial level, because you go to other people's countries. And if you want, you can reduce that. You can leave that at the commercial level, at the contract level, but it's too dangerous. When you do this, it is prudent to elevate it to the political level as well, so that there's political buy-in that underpins the commercial arrangement. And in fact, we require it in our law. The Electricity Regulation Act is written like that. Where there is any cross-border transaction, there must be a political agreement between the two countries. And the nature of this, it could be a bilateral agreement that is, you know, an agreement on energy between the two countries, but I suspect it has to graduate to a treaty because the treaty has an international standing as well. But we're watching that space. We have engaged with the utilities, and what the utilities represent and the risk associated with somebody else changing what the utilities have represented is the risk that we will then have to manage and suspect through the treaty. I'm not going to comment on, you know, I'm sure you'll understand, I'm not going to comment deliberately on the question as to whether people intelligence services are involved. But the nature of this project, this comes to the question around the servitude, the land and so on. We do have a slide that indicates the amount of land that is required.
is that on the South African side, we deal with it from a South African law point of view. Right. So this part of the servitude, if you like, so this is not text, right? This is not the exact route. But we are aware of the land issues that relate to the part of the project. The part that relates to from Inga all the way to Kolwezi, there is already an existing line. There's an existing operational line. And the idea is to push this other new line into the area. And we are aware of the risks involved with that. We have engaged with the DRC and they've assured us that, in fact, they have secured enough land for not just a transmission line, but for another transmission line, and even a road reserve within, let's say, kind of area. So from a Congolese point of view, you can follow the same route and, you know, have land issues, you know, resolved from their point of view. So if you allow me, I'm going to raise maybe that's another technical point, but it's not engineering now, it's project finance. But it answers the question around risk. So what happened, maybe we need to do that at some point, share with you a project risk matrix. And it isolates the project's political, financial, commercial, legal and regulatory, environmental, and so on and so forth. And within the political and regulatory risks, Honorable Mahende Shala, this question that you raised about how they were able to do 1, 2, and 3, and their operating is that there is no electricity law. There is a big gap at the moment as to how SNEL itself sets tariffs, how SNEL is financed, and how SNEL, and as a result, you find that it has remained a very small utility and is not able to do the things that it should do because the people that want to put money to, for example, the World Bank and them are saying, but we don't have a policy certainty in relation to that space. And that's why they have now passed the Inga law. The Inga law is specific to the Inga project, but over and above that, they're saying that they would like to also borrow from our regulatory framework so that they can also have the and incidentally, this is an energy master's program to try and get all the study countries with a similar regulatory framework so that it could, yes. Otherwise, it makes it very difficult for investment in this region. I think Honorable Mabunda has very, very important. I mean, we have in our planning framework regional integration and regional trade is one of the most critical objectives. We definitely need to have more trade between the countries in the study as well, and to rely on others. So the question around political risk and the extent to which we have, I think it was referred to as an escape law, is being taken care of in the treaty. And I think, Chair, just to answer the question, the $10 million is not for phase one. It's for subsequent phases. For the first phase, we don't have to pay anything. It's only when we go to phase two that we say we would like to exercise our right. They say, put $10 million down, so that if down the line you decide to change your mind, then you have 10 million too, so they want to have commitment. For the first phase, we've already got the commitment, and the commitment is by way of signing the treaty. So that's equivalent to the $10 million for phase one, if you like. But for subsequent phase, they say now pay additional $10 million each time we want to do that. So there is an escape. The escape is that in the treaty, it's very clear, it's subject to the phase being feasible, and we define feasibility in a particular way, and it being commercially acceptable to us, which is the issue around price. And we do have a price determination mechanism. So they can't come and say, now you are bound because we've got this phase going, and it's selling the electricity at the price, which is much more expensive than other options that we can put in place. Let me just deal with the nuclear question very quickly. In the IRP, this project sits side by side with nuclear. So it's not a substitute for or otherwise. So basically what happens is that there might well be issues of timing, but the amount of power that we need from the various options of baseload includes the mix: coal, hydro, gas, nuclear. So all of them sit comfortably, you know, side by side. It's not like this eliminates the, you know, the other option. That's the first point. The second point is that from an energy security point of view, and I think the point was raised earlier on, this is the escape clause issue, is that we have a principle that you cannot buy more than your reserve margin from next door. So you cannot depend entirely on Kahora Basa. There was a question about Kahora Basa. Because when Kahora Basa is reached out, then we have 2,000 megawatts short. That's why our reserve margin, which is let's call it 2,000 megawatts, will kick in so that it's not an issue. But where you have a huge generator like this, you have to be very careful about sitting at 18,000 megawatts from another country, and then there's a problem in there and you have 18,000 short in your system. So you have to, that's why it stays in. And at this point, we believe that the first 2,500 megawatts is fairly comfortable for us to be able to, you know, to deal with the balancing of the system from that point of view. Then, just in terms of go back in the, what are these questions you have about land rights and the timing of the procurement of that. I have indicated there is some slide that I showed here which indicates just the amount of land. I can't find it easily. The amount of land that is required to be secured and so on. You have on your slides. And that process, as I indicated, is ongoing. We don't do it on the DRC side, we do it on our side. Coming back to this project financing, let me conclude. So, in this instance, we are just a buyer. There is nothing like cost overrun in a project financing. There's nothing like that. You buy what you have received, you pay for it. Anything that is outside of that is somebody else's risk. That's how you... So it's not... We don't take construction cost, construction schedule risk. That is... That somebody else takes that. We sit at the delivery point, we say, the price is this, we sign. The power comes, the price is paid. Nothing outside of that. So that's the way that you structure. And you don't... You're not the one that is building. So if there is a delay and all of that, that's their problem. It's got nothing to do with us as the buyer. Just the cost of the lines, then Honorable Mamishale, is 68 million rand, not dollars. Sorry, I apologize for that. I think I might have. I was just saying it's 68 million rand. At that point, when this estimate was done, there was a relationship between the rand and the dollar. So this in the 2010 rand. Probably now it's more because the rand has appreciated. But as you can imagine, the line, and this is the point which we did not underscore in the treaty, we have secured what we refer to a preferential procurement for SADC countries, including South Africa companies. And the idea is that you want to sell as much of the product that is required from the project from here. What is the product? It's largely concrete, steel, for the silverware. Then going to be a lot of aluminium conductor, steel pylons, and then a lot of machines. Machines will probably be imported and so on. Right? But the idea is that you want to buy a lot of that product from South Africa because that's how we create job opportunities here. So when we say 68 million rands, it is in the context of our estimate of what we can supply from here. But if you supply it from somewhere else, it's in dollars. And therefore that cost as much changes. But 68 million rand gives you a sense what the project cost is and what is the likely tariff. Because this project does not have any operational, it doesn't have coal, the water is free, it's a flow. And so you will pay a lot of capital, but you pay very on the capital infrastructure, but you pay very little on the primary energy because there's no primary energy cost as such. And then I think there was a question about the phasing of the lines. As indicated, is that if you look at the main highway, you have no choice. It has to be end to end. So you would string that line, get all the necessary servitudes, and get even the phasing in place. So you would build the line in such a way that he can be scaled easily if you need him for the next subsequent phases. But you would not build it all at the same, you know, you would not, I think if I understood that question, I know Fandan, that this part of the line, this highway, this long one, end to end, you have no choice. You have to think that line because this is what brings the power to South Africa. Now, one of the options that we considered was that you could perhaps, because the first phase is only 4,800, right, and we're only receiving 2,800. In fact, you could sink this line here, the one on the right, right, and not the long one. And in that phase, what you would do with your 2,500, you would trade it in the sub-region. It's the phasing. So instead of us bringing it here, we get the benefit of the value, of the money, without necessarily to it. And then in the subsequent phase, as the project feasibility indicates, then you can think that second phase of that. So those are the options and the robustness of this transmission model. It's not like you would jump in all the time, you know, I mean, for the first time, and then build all of these lines on top of each other. There will be the issue around losses and losses on the line and whether we get 2,500 and the IRP. What lesson from the Mozambican line? I think that the first issue is, I have just mentioned, the issue of reserve margin. But perhaps one of the biggest lessons from the Mozambican line is that the partner has to have faith. So I don't have to tell you, the Mozambican line was initiated way, way back, pre-70s, and it was very one-sided. And what had happened is that we now, let's say, find a situation where sometimes the line is decommissioned for reasons that are spurious. And it's mainly because Mozambicans have a stake in that line, which is very low. So all the value comes to us. And that's why a win-win situation is, you know, we negotiate, I think, is very critical. So that they all want to, you know, to secure the integrity of the project. Otherwise, if there is a sense that this is one-sided, they will find ways of undermining the project and make it risky from whatever end, political, security, or whatever. So with this scheme, the idea is that, and that's why the multilateral aspect is that you can't take your line to other people's countries that get nothing. So if you get involved, then, you know, and that's a big lesson from the Mozambican one, from the Aurobata scheme relative to this one. Insofar as our sovereign rating being downgraded, I think the worst thing that could happen is that we're in the same boat. Let's put it this way, DRC does not have a credit rating, as we speak, so-called. You know, so it's not like the project would fail because of the downgrading. All it means is that there might well be a different view as to the cost of capital relative to ECOM, and the extent to which the state would have to put other mechanisms in place. But as it stands already, this off-taker has a credit rating, that's what we encourage. That off-taker does not have a credit rating, right? That off-taker, Kinshasa, does not have a credit rating. So the project is more or less, you know, a dependent on us, and when we do get downgraded, if we get downgraded, then what it means is that we'll have to revisit the cost of the borrowing. Incidentally, there is also recognition that this project everybody wants to do. So the kind of financing that is now being talked about is very concessionary. It's not like commercial. You know, it's very lenient in order to make the project work. But this is not the next question. Why the likes of Bridge Bank are very critical? Because this whole construct, incidentally, is, and I'm very saying that it's a Western construct. So it's more like your Washington consensus, central thing. It's like, you know, the World Bank are the only people there. But now suddenly you have other options. You know, the Chinese, through the BRICS Bank, they have a different view as to risk and how you can finance these kind of options. So it's not necessarily the case that if they're not going to come to the party, nobody else can come to the party. So there is definitely a possibility through the BRICS Bank. Then, just in terms of, sorry, the 68 we have dealt with, and also how the different operators pay for different raises. We have had some assistance from the IPP office in terms of technical assistance, legal assistance in relation to the project dynamics and all of that. It's, you know, for example, how we need to structure the offtake agreement and so on. So there is a process. And maybe also to get, Honorable Mohamed Shaba, you seems like you are aligned with us on that one, about securing our interest directly in the GRC with the NASA. So what we have at the moment, we have the DBSA has a permanent person sitting there, but it's a financial aspect. We now are going to take on a technical attaché, but when you talk interest, it's more than financial and technical. So there is an issue about us having a full-blown dedicated mission in the DRC in relation to the project. That's happened before in our country, so we're considering that at the moment. I've dealt with the issue on bilateral and multilateral. Multilateral, it's actually already enabled. If you look at the treaty, in the preamble in the treaty, we already recognize that there would be other players here. In particular, we have what we call the trilateral, the trilateral mechanism with Angola. So, for example, this concept here is focusing in the first phases on sending the power to the east. But the same thing can be done to the west. In fact, if you go back to 2005-06, we had what was called the WESCO project to develop TIGA. WESCO was the Western Corridor. DRC, Angola, Namibia, Botswana, South Africa. That project that failed and referred to BHP Billiton was involved. When WESCO failed, BHP Billiton tried to run with it on their own. So there is another scheme that goes to that other side, the western side, called WESCO. And that is the multilateral aspect of the project. We already recognize in the treaty that we are just anchoring the state, but in fact, it could, you know, subsequent phases don't have to follow this line. They could go right next door into Angola, extend the Angolan make the thing. Maybe that's another important point. De-risking the project, so far as the matter. Just think about it, as I indicated. For the first phase, you can build this part here, and that's the DRC that builds that. We don't have to build that. But through interconnection into Zambia, the Zambians become very happy. They're part of the process. They pay for it, and we reap the benefit. Similarly, when it comes to all these other phases, let's say 13,000, as I indicated, we can buy 13,000 megawatts. We don't have to bring it all. It doesn't mean 13,000 megawatts for ourselves. We can easily send it this way to Angola. We can send it to these countries where they need it. But we have a fairly big stake because we control the equity in front. So it's the multilateral, you know, aspect insofar as that is concerned. Have we achieved the timelines on slide 23? As I indicated, yes, they indicated that they would shoot the bid in January. As we speak, we've already had indication from the various bidders asking about the transmission solution. So that process is underway on track towards the end of June. I think, Norman Beshala, again, just another project risk issue is that they are supposed to have elections very soon, and I think that's the only worrying thing at the moment as to what would happen, what turns out being that. And that's why it's like, you know, slowly, slowly, but we're very much aware of those things. I think that covers all the questions. The $10 million fee I have indicated, it's not for the phase, it's for any subsequent phase. Yeah, I think so, sir.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, I think that covers of our concerns. We buy for power delivered, what we were concerned about really doesn't matter. It's just more on a technical, if you say somebody's going to do more technical. Just speak now, hydropower is direct current. That's how it gets developed. And you can't increase or decrease direct current through transformers for that matter. So option two would obviously, and I see you sort of lean towards that way as well, obviously be the right way to go. Safety wheeling basically means that if you use other countries' infrastructure, their leverage system, they will have to provide inverters to change it from direct to alternative current, then step up transformers to blow it up, and then they will have control over hour to hour, as you might say. So with the HVDC link that now exists, you now be able actually to relay DC current over very, very long distances. I know in the Congo, from Inga, they 1,700 and something kilometers that they take it to Katanga or wherever their copper mines is. They first made it 80 power for the transformer there, 80 power, and they bypass all their towns direct to the mines. It's still, their mines are also crippled through Inga 1 and 2 that I mentioned, only producing 50% of their capacity. But that wouldn't have anything to do with us there. We pay for only what we're getting. An obvious route would be to have that direct link in the AC current, in the DC current, directly through this link that we use for solar energy, for all renewable energy, directly here. We will still pay what we're getting at the border. Then here we will have our own step of generators, because it must be changed to alternative current here in our grid. That is obviously, we can't go any other way.
Yes, Chairperson, after listening to all the explanations, I think that the preferred way would be to plug it into the system at Kusam Bay. Yeah, there. And then through a solid power pool purchase agreement with the other countries, I would wheel it through those countries. I think that's what we should do first for the 2,100 megawatts that we can, the 2,400, but it will be less when it comes here. But I mean, we would have to export less electricity up the way, and it would benefit us hugely to do that. We must just have a good solid agreement in place for that, and we need to manage it until we want to step it up and see that it's solid and stable, the network, and then we can always build the direct line if need be. But I think that is an A-grade project, and I don't think that this project at the moment we can qualify as an A-grade. There is too much risk involved to it, so I would do it the way plugging into the system, power with a power pool, have good agreements, and then wheel it out. I think that would be my recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the also pleasure comment. I don't think Mr. Fanny want to comment on those. Nothing. Yeah, and our members, I think it's okay for us towards the end of the year will be an important milestone to return to see what's happening in this project. Unless issues arise with regard to the additional treaties which may have to come back to Parliament between now and the end of the year. And I'm sure they've made important comments that this is an important project. But this is just one project with regard to the integration and industrialization of the African continent. This is just one project. There are many other projects. So you can also de-risk with other projects so that Yeah, if you want to say what I mean. So that's important. I think we're going to have to see this through. Now when people talk about, just in the discussion, talk about Africa rising and the growth rate that we witness, including just in the countries just around South Africa. And then we look at us, we look at them. You know, one, because we're not part of the continent. Because historically we're not a part of the continent. So when the continent grows, we lay him behind and you ask the question, why is it that the rest of the countries in the continent are growing? We're not. So it's an important thing for the future. So part of all of the other projects that we're involved in. So thanks very much. I know this is not as good as a new year discussion, but it's an important project, however. So we'll call it back, most probably towards the end of the year, because I think an important part is the choosing of the winning bidder of the concessionaire, so that we have certainty that we think are moving forward. Otherwise, thanks, honorable members. See you next Tuesday. Oh, no. No. We're not seeing you next Tuesday. Okay. And so, we'll have a short recess. And, we'll be back on the 12th. So, enjoy your constituency work and the short holiday that you might manage in between. Thanks a lot.